So, Marley, today's episode is with Kristen, who is the DFL from Mid-South. We are recording this intro after talking to her.
Yeah.
And I'm processing everything we just heard. Her story is so incredible on so many levels.
She has a very personal connection to her body and living in a bigger body. The amount of adversity that she faced. And I knew that she was struggling with asthma because she came across the finish line and was like, does anybody have an inhaler? And we were able to find her an inhaler. But I didn't know all the other things that went wrong. For most other riders, if one of those things had gone wrong, and we're not going to spill the beans, you're going to hear about it directly from Kristen. But if any one of those things had gone wrong, it would have been enough to say, nah, I'm done. We'll try again a different day.
Yep. There's always next year.
And she just kept going.
She just kept going. And I think I mentioned this in the episode, but this is what I'm starting to appreciate the most about the DFL spirit, is that it is opening you up to complete it if you want to and you can. And it's not cutting you short. It is just letting you relax into the ride that you're going to have that day, whether you are a pro or whether you are there for your first time. I get nervous that these DFL conversations are going to be the same over and over again, and they're not. And also, I think it's so important to hammer this idea home,
yeah,
that this is important in expanding the sport.
100%. There was also a really interesting conversation that happened this year, because we say that you can take as long as you want to, but I found out that that's actually not true. So we did have a couple folks get pulled off the course after like a very tough conversation with Crystal and the organizers. And I went round and round with the organizers about this. I was like, hey guys, we tell everybody that, you know, you can take as long as you want and we'll be out there all night for you. But it turns out their permits only go to a certain time, specifically with emergency medical services. And so apparently the conversation that happens is, hey, based on the pace that you're going, you're projected to have a 2-day finish and we don't have the permits for that. Okay. So, you know, you are an adult, you can choose to keep riding, but we will not be able to have the support for you. And it's honestly kind of a bummer to hear that and to know that, because in my brain, I was like, no, we keep it open for everybody. But then in talking to the organizers, it's like they do have to maintain a certain minimum pace. And truly, like, it's not a fast pace, as we learned from Kristen. So technically it was 106 miles divided by 15.5. So 6.8 miles an hour. So you don't have to maintain a fast pace, but you do need to keep moving. And I think that was what a couple of folks who got pulled, they were just dilly-dallying. You know, I was at the first aid station with somebody, and I was like, oh, you decided to do the 50. I thought you're doing the 100. And they were like, no, I'm doing the 100. And I was like, you're at mile 25 and it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon. You need to get moving. And they were just like chit-chatting and hanging out. And I think, you know, that's the messaging that we need to work on, is like, you can take a long time,
yeah,
but you need to keep moving. And part of that is respect for the Jeep drivers and the emergency medical responders and all the people waiting for you at the finish line. Like, you got to keep moving. You got to keep being efficient with your time, because there's a lot of folks out there who are taking their own time and volunteering to be out there with you.
Yes. And I do think that is then undermining the spirit of DFL, which is that you've just worked hard to get here. You haven't dilly-dallied your way to the finish line.
It's something that I am committed to working on with Mid-South. We got to figure out how to get that message out there in a way that relays the importance of it, but also encourages folks to ride at their own pace.
I'm really excited to share Kristen's story with the world. Let's go.
Welcome to All Bodies on Bikes, the podcast, where all bodies are good bodies, all bikes are good bikes, and all rides are celebrated.
All Bodies on Bikes is a movement to create and foster a radically inclusive bike community. So join your hosts. I'm Ellen.
And I'm Marley.
As we explore the complexities of the biking world, help us break down barriers and create the world that we want to see.
Come along for the ride. We are continuing our conversation about Mid-South today, celebrating our official DFL rider. For folks just tuning in, DFL stands for Dead Effing Last. And keen listeners might remember that we've had this conversation a couple times now. I was the DFL rider in 2023, and then we had Beth McBride on. Maybe we'll provide a link to her episode in 2024. And then 2025, the ride didn't happen because of wildfires. But we are back, baby. And we have this year's DFL rider, Kristen. I hope I say your last name right. I should know this after knowing you for a couple years now. Owen Ray?
Yep.
Yeah. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It was a wild ride.
Tell us more.
Yeah, I can't wait to dig in and hear more about it. So I guess just start off, tell us a little about who you are, your relationship to bikes, and why you went to Mid-South.
Yeah, I have been obsessed with bikes my whole life. I started watching the Tour de France in, I think, 1999, and I've watched every year, every moment of every year since. I've watched every one of the Tour de France Femme twice. So I started as a cycling fan. And I also was a latchkey kid in the 90s. So bikes were a way to kind of get out and get some freedom and get out of my house. So I didn't actually have a driver's license until like I graduated grad school. So a bike was my main form of transportation up until like my late 20s. And I didn't really turn it into any sort of exercise related thing. It was just transportation and fun until probably 6 or 7 years ago. I was kind of processing the loss of my mom, who died as a result of gastric bypass surgery, and trying to find a way to like love my fat body and move it in an intentional way. And cycling, of course, was the thing that was always there for me. So I started riding more, longer distances, riding with a couple of friends. I found All Bodies on Bikes and was on the Steamboat team 2 years ago in 2024. So I did a couple of events leading up to that, but those were my first organized events. So All Bodies on Bikes provided sort of the structure and the scaffolding to help me figure out how to take my like what felt like a very internal, personal, solo activity and turn it into something that I could do with other people. So ever since then, I've been trying to find other events, other ways to connect with the All Bodies on Bikes community. And I'm really excited to have been able to work Mid-South into my schedule this year, because all of the folks on the ABOB team told me that the vibes there are simply unmatched, and they were absolutely right.
Can I ask a personal question about the fact that your mom died from complications of gastric bypass, like, which is typically something that a larger body person would do to try to make it into a smaller body? So yeah, what you said about like that prompting some thoughts and acceptance for you, like, how does that all play in?
Yeah. And this is actually what I talked about in my application for the ABOB team a couple of years ago. Because it was a huge formative experience in my life. My mom didn't have any comorbid conditions, right? So she mm-hmm. didn't have diabetes. She didn't have heart disease. She had some joint pain, but who doesn't their early 50s? But her doctors told her at her weight, she wouldn't live to see her daughters get married, that she wouldn't get to spend her life with us. And nobody mm-hmm. ever told her that it was okay to just live her life fat, that she could just continue in the body that she had, and that there should be support for doing that. And so she chose to go through with the surgery and had complications and passed. And I think for me, you know, I did a lot of grieving and a lot of thinking about that after it happened. And the biggest conclusion that I came to was that I wanted to be the example of like, it's okay to live your life to the fullest in the body that you are in, and that taking drastic steps to change that for some idea of a future life might lead you down a path that isn't as fulfilling or as beautiful or as full as the one that you could be living right now.
That's beautiful. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, that's so powerful. Thank you. I
just do it fat. It's
not fat.
Exactly. Just do it fat. Yeah.
Right. And yeah, and I guess you said this was 6 or 7 years ago. I do think partially in part of like All Bodies and similar organizations and similar campaigns, that narrative is beginning to change. And there's a lot of research that's coming out to say the fat isn't the problem. It's the stigma and it's the support. Like you said, like if she'd have had anyone say, you can be healthy in this body instead of everything about this body is wrong. Everything could have been different. So I'm sorry that you have to carry that grief with you, but thank you for sharing. Do you want to get into how was training for Mid-South?
It's so early in the season for spending many hours on the bike. I've been riding all winter, more than I usually do in the winter. But it's...
Sorry, clarification. Where are you based?
Oh, I'm in Oregon, the sort of central Willamette Valley. Yeah, okay. So it rains a lot here in the winter. I have, over the years, cycling equipment for larger bodies has gotten better, but one of the things that I find that's still really missing is some of that like inclement weather gear. Mm-hmm. Like I cannot find shoe covers that will fit around my calves. So my shoes get soaked through if I'm riding outside for any long time in the winter here when it's raining. So I've been riding indoors a lot, which I enjoy. I've been rewatching old Tour de France Femme, sitting on my trainer inside. But it's so my legs would have been great, but all of those soft tissues, you know, your wrists and palms and your kind of undercarriage and stuff really need those long hours on the bike to be ready to spend 15 and a half hours in the saddle. So I was maybe not as prepared for that part of it as I would have liked to be.
Sure.
And the leg strength didn't really end up mattering because of other problems that I had on course. I don't think I ended up getting out of zone one basically all day. So I was very well within my wattage comfort zone, going super slow all day.
Is zone one a heart rate thing?
So as someone who cycles a lot, I have a power meter on my bike. So it tells me exactly how many watts I'm putting out by turning the pedals all the time. So yeah, it's both a correlation between your heart rate and the power zone that your body uses different energy systems to produce. So it's kind of the lowest, easiest, what would be considered like a recovery pace. That's what I was doing. Okay, cool. It didn't feel like recovery, but
sure. We should have a whole episode diving into that. I'm not super familiar with those things, Marley.
Honestly, I'm not either. Like, I kind of know a little bit. I've never used a power meter, and I'm super curious about it. So it sounds like you were prepared to be out there all day. Going into the 100, had you ever ridden anything of this distance? And what was your plan for the day? What did you expect to happen?
I had not ridden anything of that distance. I pretty regularly do about maybe 60-mile rides on the road at home. My partner and I like to ride to the next couple of towns over and get some food and ride back, make a nice long day of it. But I think the longest I had ever done on gravel was probably about 56 miles. And my longest actual ride at all on the road was maybe 75 miles. And that was a little while ago. I knew that it was going to be a big stretch for me, but I also know, and I was told by the All Bodies on Bikes team, that Mid-South was the place to be able to challenge yourself, that the structures were in place to support a really long effort, that I was going to be safe and taken care of and not forgotten about on the course for however long it took me. So I felt pretty comfortable going in that I could take my time and just keep pedaling and that I would eventually make it to the end. I did make a lot of plans about what I thought the day would look like. One of those was working with my partner, who is a physician, to strategize exactly how I was going to control my asthma out on course. So I had a very specific plan for when I was going to use my inhaler throughout the day. And then I ended up forgetting it at the hotel room as I was leaving. So that was sort of the start of my problems for the day, and all of my plans gone out the window. And from that point on, I just needed to keep the pedals turning over till I had to quit or got to the finish, whichever came first.
Wow. That is a big throw off. So, and especially because they're so famously dusty on gravel roads.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh,
and it was really cold at the start. So the cold air really kind of constricts your lungs a lot. And, one of the biggest challenges I had, I think, was since I had kind of been thrown into an asthma attack right from the start of the day, that's part of why I was putting out such low power all day, because I was trying to keep my lungs from going into panic mode.
Sure.
But it's also like a real mental struggle, because when your body feels like it can't breathe, it's a process to keep the panic from welling up, to keep all of those systems from setting off alarm bells all over your body so that you can, you know, try and stay calm and focused on the task at hand and not just like, oh my God, I'm dying. I need to stop this right this second. So it was a lot of kind of an exercise in meditation all day.
I was going to ask, what was your strategy from that? What was helping your lungs not freak out?
Like trying to keep my pace as steady and slow as I could. I did a lot of recovery on the downhill. Mid-South is beautiful rolling hills. So you make it up to the top and then you have a little moment to relax, to kind of loosen everything up. I did a lot of like shaking out my muscles and trying to release some of that tension on the way down. And then just, trying to get the time to pass. My phone was dying all day. So I was in silence a lot of the time. So doing a lot of mental math, counting down miles and minutes and time to the next, hilltop and singing terrible 90s country songs in my head as I had nothing to listen to and no one to talk to all day, just trying to distract myself.
Wow. This feels like a very tame version of like 127 hours or something. Like, here you go. Everything's gone wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was sort of in the throes of this asthma attack all day. And then that sort of kind of cascaded into 1,000 other things going wrong. At some point I stopped and did some wrenching on my bike. I couldn't get into my lowest gear, which I really needed for trying to keep my lungs calm. So I stopped and I was adjusting the limiter screws on my derailleur, trying to fix things on the side of the road. And then at some point between aid station one and aid station two, I had a nosebleed for like 20 miles. So I was stopping to try and get that to clot. And then as soon as I would start riding again, it would start bleeding again. So that felt like it went on forever and ever. And I was making the slowest progress with that.
For anybody who's listening and not watching, Marley and my jaws both just went like you just keep adding details.
I have no idea why that's never happened to me on a ride before. I can only blame it on maybe the difference between the moisture between Oregon and Oklahoma. Maybe.
And just the dust, like if you're at the back of the pack, DFL, so like you've got everybody else's dust kicked up.
And yeah, I wasn't blooming, allergies, all the things.
Yeah. And I wasn't at the back. I'm always a back of the pack rider. Right. I'm always going to be in the last 10% of the field, if not later. But I was not DFL until
they're going to be another detail right now.
Yeah. I missed the second aid station. So there are only 3 aid stations on course and they're like 35 miles apart. So I got to the first aid station and then as I was maybe 10 miles away from the second aid station, I was like, I'm just going to push really hard. I'll get there. I'm going to finish all of my water before I get there so that I can completely refill and be ready to go to the final aid station. And I had been given some bad information from someone else on course. I stopped to help some gentlemen fix a flat on their bikes, which was really fun. I felt like the girl who knew how to use plugs that they didn't know how to. I thought I was going to push really hard and I'd get to the aid station. And then somehow I took a wrong turn in Guthrie and missed it by like 2 blocks. To about mile 70 and realized that the aid station was nowhere in sight and I was 100% out of water and I only had 10% battery on my phone, I turned my phone on and I called the Jeep rescue to come bring me some water. And they kept asking, do you need to be rescued? Do you want us to pick you up? And I said, no, I want to keep going. I just need water. I'm completely out. And so they told me to ride about a half mile ahead and wait for them there. And so I did, but the Jeep rescue went the wrong way on the road. It ended up taking about 25, 30 minutes for them to find me on the side of the road as I sat there and waited for them with my phone off, unable to communicate with them, trying to save my battery. And in that time, everyone who had been behind me passed me. So I got to watch as the DFL approached me and sat on my shoulders. So I sat there on the side of the road. And I said hi to folks and took some pictures with folks. A couple of the this year's ABOB team came by and that was really nice. But yeah, so from about mile 70 on, I knew that I was going to be in last place because I had sat there and watched everyone that was behind me go past But I got my water and I got back on the road and kind of yo-yoed on and off the back with Nicole from this year's All Bodies on Bikes team the whole rest of the race. And it was very slow going, but we made it.
Kind of a funny behind the scenes story. So I was in the control room a little bit with the Ride with GPS folks and the Jeep control. And they nicknamed you Sweet Talking Kristen.
yeah, the dispatcher was so sweet at the finish line. He was like, I can't believe it's you. You were the one who was on our board all day. Sweet Talking Kristen. Yeah.
Yeah. And I just, I love that, you know, the support of the Mid-South team that you were able to call them and get water and say, no, I'm fine. I can keep going. And actually we had another teammate, Carol, who called and her bike computer had died and she needed a battery and she called and she got a battery. And
that's awesome.
I can't think of any other race where that level of support would be provided.
No.
Yeah. They let me charge my phone in the Jeep that was following me for, you know, they charged it in there for probably half an hour or so that I could finally have a little bit of music and entertainment back after like 6 hours of silence on by myself on the road. And of course they lit my way. Yeah. I had brought one headlight because I knew I would be out after dark, but I thought I would only be out after dark for an hour or less. And I ended up out after dark for, you know, 4.5 hours or so. So having the Jeep Rescue following behind me and lighting my way, especially because some of the more technical parts of the route were in that last bit after dark, really, I think, probably saved my life. Descending at 30 miles an hour on gravel in the dark is terrifying. So it was really helpful to have the folks right there with me, both in case anything happened, but also both literally and figuratively lighting my way as we went.
I have to ask. So, you know, objectively, you were having an asthma attack. You ran out of water. You missed an aid station. Your bike's not shifting. What compelled you to keep going? I think so many people would have quit.
Yeah, I don't know. I just kept thinking, like, I mean, with the Jeep Rescue right there with you, you know that you can quit at any moment. I could have said that I'll get off my bike and get in the Jeep literally at any part of that course. And I think maybe in some ways that would have made it easier to quit or harder to keep going, but it also made it easier to keep going because I knew I could, if I could just get over this next hill, if I could just get down the other side of this next hill and halfway up the next one, that, you know, breaking it down into these little pieces that I just needed to do this little bit more. And then also because of the community that Mid-South brings, and because I knew that all of you were waiting at the finish line and there was going to be a big party and that folks were drinking free beer and having, you know, spraying champagne, and there was a band, I knew that it would be more fun to roll into town under the power of my own two wheels than it would be to roll in the back of a Jeep. So I had something fun to look forward to, which isn't the case at a lot of races where, you know, you're just going to wander into an abandoned, you know, pretty empty, packed up expo or finish line. This was a night and day experience to what I think most races are like.
I love that that was the motivating factor. It's interesting that you said the Jeep being there was actually motivating to you. We've had a couple people say this Jeep is all up on my back and it's stressing me out.
Yeah. They were so kind. And I know at some point they had picked up and rescued some folks who had abandoned earlier who would then cheer for me from the Jeep. So like my friend Kate from the All Bodies and Bikes team, it's just like, I was yelling for you from the Jeep. So knowing that there were folks that I knew in the Jeep, some of the, you know, getting the chance to kind of chat with them was really motivating. There was also a film crew with me for the last bit. And so they were in front of me and the Jeep was behind me. And that was a little bit weird, but also fun and strange and surreal.
You can blame me for that. So we're making a DFL documentary. And because of my experience, three, four years ago now, I wanted other people to experience what it's like being in the back all by yourself and then coming across that finish line. So I'm sorry if it was awful, but I kept thinking
I should do something fun for them, but I was just so focused on everything that I needed to be doing in that moment, that I don't think they got very good footage. I was very head down, keep pedaling.
I think that's exactly the footage they need.
I agree. Yeah, I think there's a misconception that I've heard it from folks of like, oh, you guys are trying to get DFL or you're just out there wasting time and dilly-dallying. And that is not the case. I mean, maybe for some folks, but sounds like for you, not the case at all.
Yeah, I did. I did a lot of stopping. And every time I did, the Jeep would come up and ask me if I was okay. and I always was. A lot of it was kind of, you know, rearranging my bike shorts and my chamois. I found out as I was unpacking my bike yesterday that at some point in the race, I broke my saddle. May have contributed to why I was having so much saddle pain and why I kept having to stop and rearrange. Yeah. That part was also a little weird, having people, you know, I'm like, no, I really just need to pull my shorts out of my butt right now. They want to check in on you. It's like, no, I'm just having a little intimate moment by myself here on the side of the road. Thank you. I'm fine.
Okay, so hang on. I'm trying to write this down. So you have asthma with no inhaler. You have shorts up your butt. You have gears that don't work.
Mm-hmm. A broken saddle.
That doesn't normally bleed.
Yeah.
There's something I'm missing, I think, in this.
I missed a whole aid station and completely ran out of water.
Right. You didn't have water. You didn't have a phone.
Yep.
You didn't have music.
Yeah.
I just feel like, I think what I want to call out here is that Mid-South opened the door for all of those things, any one of those things to hold someone back and still finish.
Also, and you changed somebody else's tire.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And you got, like, the support crew lost you for a minute. Mm-hmm. Like, there's just a lot. So many things went wrong and you still got to finish. Like, you still got to have the full authentic experience. And so I guess I'm just saying there are so many accessibility things in everything that got packaged up in your one ride that having the course open opens up the world of cycling to more people.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I love that.
I got the experience of facing all of those things and continuing anyways. And even though it ended up taking me 15 and a half hours when I thought it would only take me 11 hours. I got to experience those last 4.5 hours of struggle that are a part of me now and who I will be for the rest of my life. And Mid-South gifted that ability to me.
Is there a better way to end this?
There's something I want to dig into a little bit. Talk to me about the juxtaposition of, you know, this elite racing that you have such passion for and the kind of cycling that you and I do and that we all do. How does that all relate to each other? And I don't really know what I'm asking, but I would just love to hear kind of about that.
Well, for one thing,
today's episode of the All Bodies on Bikes podcast is brought to you by biketiresdirect.com with a huge selection of inventory from tires to clothing, hydration, nutrition, basically anything you need for cycling. biketiresdirect.com is your go-to. Use the code ALLBODS, that's ALLBODS, all capital letters, for a 10% discount. And 6% of that comes back to All Bodies on Bikes. So you're getting a discount and the organization is getting supported. Thank you so much to Bike Tires Direct for your support.
I don't think I ever thought that I would get to have the experience of rolling into a finish line to a cheering crowd. So I've never felt more like a pro in my life, which is a lot of what I find fun about riding my bike personally, is that it's like role playing as these people that I've watched on my TV screen my whole life. But also, there's a tradition in the Tour de France called the Lanterne Rouge, which is the final finisher of the Tour de France, which in recent years has become kind of a coveted prize. So it's the slowest time of all of the folks who finish the race, and it's celebrated because you still finished. So it's like the pro version of the DFL at the Tour de France. And so I am planning on getting a tattoo of a red lantern, the Lantern Rouge, with my DFL Longhorn skull somehow incorporated into it, to kind of celebrate the connection between what it is that I did and what they do all the time, and this sport that has been around for, you know, almost 200 years now, that I think is the most beautiful thing in the world and is one of the only professional sports that we can watch that we also get to participate in. And what I do looks very different to what they do. But there's a connecting line there that means a ton to me. And I got to have an experience I don't think I ever imagined could happen and feel a little bit like, you know, like Annemiek van Vleuten crossing a finish line.
That's so cool. I love how you phrased that. Nice job. Yeah. I'm going to have a hard time cutting anything out of this episode.
I don't think you need to. I think this is so good. And then one last question. So the DFL gets a big Longhorn skull. I'm looking at mine right next to me, and I was lucky to drive mine home. How in the hell did you get that 5-foot Longhorn skull home?
I want to give a huge thank you to the folks at District Bicycles. So Bobby Wintle and his team are going to package it up in a bike box for me. I know they have a couple of other things from some local businesses to ship with it. But I took it into the store on the morning after the race. So as I was carrying it through downtown Stillwater, I got stopped by multiple people who said, "Are you Kristen?" And it was so weird that people knew my name. And they wanted to see the skull, got my picture taken with some folks. I felt like a little Stillwater celebrity. But yeah, they're, I think, taking a week off to close the shop and get a little break, but then it'll be winging its way through the mail to me. They did suggest that I might get that they would buy me a second seat on the plane and I could fly with it next to me in a seat. But I don't think I could have managed the logistics of that in my bike bag all at once.
That would be a lot, but it
was. Yeah, but it would have been a very fun experience.
Yeah.
If your skull was anything like mine, it was really smelly for the first year or two.
Yeah, I'll have to get some advice from you about how to display it and what kind of fun things to do with it.
Maybe 100%. Outside.
Yeah, exactly. Let your sheep nibble on it, maybe.
Yeah, I might hang it in the sheep barn for a while until it's done.
Yeah, natural.
Yeah.
Natural place to hang a skull. I assumed it was like a passed from person to person thing. I love that you all get your own skull. What an Oklahoma.
I just assumed it was for photos at the finish line and it belonged to the race or something. Oh. I had no idea I would be getting. I might have actually tried for DFL if I had known.
I feel like in all of our DFL conversations, this is maybe an important overlooked detail, Marley. Yeah. If you get DFL, you have to now you own a 5-foot skull.
Yeah, you have to figure out how to get it home. It's kind of cool there. So the rancher who the skull comes from, he was at the finish line, and I've seen pictures of you. I don't know if you got a chance to chat with him, but he is the friendliest guy, and he's like so really sweet, really wants me to come out there and source the skull next year. And I'm like,
like pick the animal?
No. Okay. So like,
that's what I thought too, Kristen.
You, I was like, that sacrificed.
That is a fresh skull.
No, apparently, like cows die, and you're a farmer rancher. Like animals die pretty naturally, and so when their cow dies, they source the skull and then they let it fester. I don't really know how.
I don't think it's fester, but sure.
Well, they have There's to like clean out. They have to like clean out the brains, and I don't really know. This is so gross. I don't know how it works. But the rancher was there, and he is so generous every year, and it's like one of his favorite things to do. And I don't know. I don't think he even rides bikes, but it's just like a testament to the Stillwater community. You know, you've got so many people out there caring for you, and the Jeep drivers and everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah. Ellen, I'm going to make you do so much editing because I still have so many more questions. Can I keep asking?
Okay. Yeah. Okay. I got time.
I just want to know, so what was going through your brain as you came into town? What did that feel like?
I stopped on the edge of town as I was sort of making the last turn. Well, okay. So a couple of blocks before that, I had the Jeep pull up next to me and spent a little moment with them. I said, "Hey, guess what? I think I'm going to make it," to them. And they were like, "Of course you are. We've known you were going to make it this whole time." But I don't think I really believed it until I could kind of see the lights of town coming in. And then as I made that last turn, Crystal Wintle was on the side of the road and she yelled, "Go, Kristen." And I rode maybe 15 feet past her. And then I said, "No, wait, I'm going to stop for a hug." And so I stopped and I got off my bike and hugged her because I kind of wanted a moment of the quiet and the stillness before heading into that chaos of a party. And then, yeah, I knew it would be big. I had no idea it would be as big as it was. I've never seen so many cameras and microphones and bottles of champagne and happy, cheering people who had ridden their own races all day and must have been exhausted and should have been in bed, you know, 4 hours before that, but stayed up to party with me on the finish line. I got a lot of champagne in my eyes and all over my bike and a little bit down my throat. But yeah, everybody wanted a hug and a smile. And I think I probably was talking 10,000 miles a minute because I didn't have enough oxygen to my brain. And I think you said to me, you're the most upbeat DFL we've ever had. I think I was just delirious by that point. Just the kind of wave of energy that came from all of those people somehow got into me. And I didn't get to bed for several hours after that. When I finally got home, it took a while to come down off of that energy high. So I was really glad that I took that moment to have a quiet second before heading into all of that.
I also love that you were able to give Crystal a hug. I think she's the unsung hero of Mid-South. You know, Bobby is at the finish line and tagged in every photo and gives every finisher a big hug. And Crystal is just kind of the behind the scenes workhorse. So
yeah,
I love and appreciate that. And she actually told me, she told me about it later and said after you left, she just started bawling because it was like, yeah, I don't think she expects recognition, but to get that from you, I think was really meaningful. So thanks for doing that.
Yeah, she was at the last aid station, which is only 10 miles before the finish. You know, they have the Shay out there. You can take a load off and sit down on the couch. I thought I might never get up off of it. But they, you know, she was there really just like shoving a Dr. Pepper in my hand and a bag of Cheez-Its and you know, asking, refilling my water. And yeah, it was. We're really well taken care of at a time when I don't think that we could function very well on our own. So there's a whole team behind getting that last 10 miles done.
Awesome. I think those are all my questions.
Okay. I have a question for you, Marley.
Oh.
Which maybe we can maybe let Kristen go because I don't know. Let's just stay. Did it work to have the GPS on the final person, or like with Ride with GPS, you had mentioned that you were going to do like a tracker. Did you?
So we didn't end up getting the live streaming going. I think this was the first year that they had, you know, live streaming of the pros and cameras out throughout the day. It was actually really funny. So Kristen had mentioned that she was kind of yo-yoing with Nicole, and at the finish line, we saw Nicole, like somebody was like, DFL's on their way. They're super close. They're 2 miles out. And then we saw Nicole's light coming in and somebody started popping champagne and everybody was like, it's the DFL. And me and Kevin from Ride with GPS were like, no, that's not DFL. But the cat was out of the bag. And so Belle and the Vertigo Waves, which was the band at the finish line, started playing their song DFL. Nicole came across, all the media's there, and like she basically got a DFL celebration. Yay. Yay. And then we were like, Nicole's not DFL. it was really fun to celebrate her, but it was like we all knew because when DFL comes in, the Jeeps are with her or whoever. And so, you know, Nicole was the solo light and me and Kevin were like, oh crap, what are we gonna do? But luckily they had plenty of champagne, so we celebrated Nicole, which honestly I think is awesome because she was out there, she came in maybe 10 minutes before you, 15 minutes before you, and then we kind of reset. Belle and the Vertigo Waves made a joke and they were like, okay, that was just a dress rehearsal. So then I time is non-existent when you're down there, you're just having so much fun and dancing and partying. So I think you were maybe 10 minutes after Nicole, we were like fully ready and it was like, okay, here she comes. But it just feels so funny because we all knew, but there's just this energy and this chaos down there that once it starts you can't put it back in the bag. It was funny, like the control room is in like a couple blocks away from the finish line and they're tracking all day and they've got a list of everybody who calls in. And so when I went in there to do the DFL documentary and we were interviewing the control room folks, I saw the list and I saw your name on there, Kristen, because you had called. I saw Carol's name and I was like, oh God, my people are dropping out. And they were like, no, no, no. They just called because they record every call to keep tabs on people. Yeah, we knew exactly where you were at, kind of.
Yeah, my whole family thought I had dropped out because I missed the second aid station. So it said that I had DNF'd. So I was up on the website most of the day saying that I had dropped out, but I hadn't called anyone because my phone was dead. So they didn't know what had happened to me.
That just reminded me, we got a message on the All Bodies on Bikes Instagram. I should look it up. I think it's from your sister-in-law or your sister. Probably. Saying, hey, you know, Kristen's out there riding. We haven't heard from her all day. We can't find her. Can you let us know what's going on? And I wrote back and I was like, yes, we know exactly where she's at. She's doing great. And then you came across the line like 5-10 minutes later. So it was really, really sweet. Like, I love that your family was watching from afar.
I'm so glad that Nicole got the whole shebang at the finish line too. She absolutely deserved it. We didn't talk about it on the route, but she kept trying really hard to stay right in front of me. So I assumed that she didn't want to be DFL, but I should have asked her if she did. I was going as fast as I could, so she would have had to slow down to get behind me. But I'm really glad that we both got the party because we were out there for a long time, just the two of us.
Yeah. And DFL, it's not one of those things you can plan, you know, if she wanted DF, like you can't plan for it. You know, we had Jared, on here, Jared Alder, about a month ago talking about DFL, with Mid-South. And I know they were really excited about potentially getting it. And we were texting all day and I was like, you're going real fast. And they were like, yeah, I got the zoomies. And it's like, you can't predict what's going to happen out there. So
they were one of the folks who passed me as I was stopped on the side of the road and they stopped and took my portrait as I was standing there. So I got to meet them as I waited.
That's so great.
Yeah.
Cool. My favorite part about this whole conversation is just like the entire life you lived out there. Like you had so many adventures and stories that a lot of people will never experience in their whole life. And you did it in 15 and a half hours. So yeah, just massive, massive congratulations. What's next for you?
A couple of local races. And then this summer I'm going to the Tour de France Femmes. So excited about that. Finally getting, after this lifetime of love, finally getting to go see the race in person. So
training up to DFL there. Are you like, do you think you're going to be at the front of the pack or the back of the pack?
Definitely the back of the pack. Always. Okay. but we're going to climb Mont Ventoux, the most fearsome mountain in cycling, who has claimed a life and who Eddie Merckx had to have oxygen at the top of. So we'll see how we do, but there'll be a lot of training between now and then.
I mean,
you're going to do great.
Well, you've already done a race without oxygen, so.
It's true.
Kristen, if folks want to follow along with your life, we didn't even talk about it, but you also play roller derby. if folks want to follow along, where can they find you?
I'm on Instagram as Making Morel. So Morel, like the mushroom, Morel. Mm-hmm. And it's a kind of a combination of my roller derby, my cycling, and of course my fiber arts and knitting. I post stories of my sheep all the time because they're adorable. I do a lot of cycling related knitting. So if you're interested in that, that's where you can find me.
Next on our podcast, an entire hour dedicated to that, to knowing more.
Also, I still want to come down and see your sheep, and maybe you're going to shear them. So I'm gonna come down before that. I think we can talk offline about that.
Okay,
amazing. Yeah. Congratulations, Kristen. Oh, go ahead.
Thank you. For the record, my roller derby name is Betty Merckx. So I'm named after Eddie Merckx, the greatest cyclist of all time, but also because I'll merc you on the track. So like take you out in internet speak.
I love it. Congratulations. This is all very exciting. Thanks for joining us, Kristen.
Thanks, Kristen.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye. Bye.